So today we're thinking together about the question of life, and the question in particular of what are you living for? What are you living for? Some years ago, an anthropologist named Ernest Becker wrote a book called The Denial of Death, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for this book. And near the beginning of the book, he describes something that he claims is fundamental to every single human being. And it is the need for self-worth. He describes it as the condition for life. So much so that according to Becker in that book, every single one of us is desperately seeking after what he called cosmic significance. What did he mean? I think he meant that all of us, whoever we are, have seemingly got this kind of inbuilt need for something that gives us a reason for being. That's something that gives us that sense of contentment that we crave. Something that gives us the sense of worth that we're all longing for. And Becker actually goes even one step further in talking about all this. He says, that need that we've got for worth is so powerful that whatever it is that we're looking to give us that sense of worth, it's essentially a God to us. That even if we don't think of ourselves, maybe you don't, as religious in any sense at all, we're all looking to something in life with devotion and passion that it is essentially our God. So this morning we're going to have a bit of a think about this area and about what it is that each of us is living for. What it is that you're looking for to bring you this meaning and satisfaction and contentment that we so desperately need. And I want to do that with you by looking at some words that Jesus said in this passage that we had read for us by Lee just now. Because in these verses, Jesus is addressing this very subject. He's talking about life. He's talking about identity. And in these words that we look at together now, Jesus sets before us two possibilities. He's putting out for us two options, or two paths, if you like. And he makes a really, really amazing claim. Jesus says that of these two paths that he is going to talk about, one of them, if you follow it, will lead you to find true life. And he says that the other one, if you follow it, will result in you losing true life. Now, if you're here for the first time today, maybe you've come pretty skeptical about Christianity for very good reasons. Maybe you're really just not convinced about much of what Christianity will claim. So I just want to put this out here right at the start. The things that Jesus talks about in this passage are really, really big things. They're hugely significant things. And in fact, as we're going to see, Jesus claims to be the one who can unlock true life for you. Now, if that is not true, and if it's a load of rubbish, then you haven't lost anything at all. But what if it is? What if there is something in what Jesus is saying? If there is, it could change everything for you. So I'm really glad you've come. And I'm really glad that we've got the chance to spend these minutes together looking at this question. So what I'm going to do for the rest of the time is look at these two options that Jesus gives us. And the first one is in verse 35 of the passage. And I've given it this heading, gain the world but lose your life. Jesus poses a really, really penetrating question in verse 36. He says this, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Now, if we're going to make sense of that question, we need to do a bit of thinking about what Jesus meant by gain the world. Now, I guess it's true to say that every culture has got a set of things that it points to. And the culture says, look, if you get these things, and if you achieve these things, if you become these things, then you're somebody. Then you become a person, of significance, you find fulfillment, you find contentment. And so when Jesus says, if you gain the whole world, he's talking about gaining those things. So what are they for us? That's the next question. Well, I haven't got time this morning to talk about them all, and you're probably quite relieved about that, but I want to talk about just a few of the big things that many people in our culture are living for, ways that essentially we're trying to gain the whole world. And the first one I want to talk about is wealth. A couple of years ago in America, there was a really, really interesting survey carried out where people were asked the question, how much income would it take? At what level of earnings would you need to be content? It's a great question. I wonder what you would answer. Here's what they found. Those who were earning an average of $25,000 a year believed that it would take $54,000 a year to bring them the life that they would be satisfied with it. So in their minds, $54,000 a year, that'll do it. They weren't satisfied with 25, but oh, if they could get 54,000 a year, they would have everything they need and finally be content. But then there was the group that on average earned around the $100,000 a year mark. Now, if those guys who were on $25,000 a year were right, they would all have said, well, the level of earnings that satisfies us, we reached that one when we reached the golden landmark of $54,000. We've been satisfied completely ever since we hit that level. But, you know, funnily enough, none of them said that whatsoever. On average, those earning $100,000 a year believed that it would take $192,000 a year to give them the satisfaction they long for. Everybody thinks you kind of need twice as much. I think that's really striking because it tells you one very simple but incredibly significant thing. That no matter how much we have, it is never enough. It's never enough. I guess many of you have heard of John D. Rockefeller. He was a very famous oil magnate quite a while ago. At one time, the richest man in the world and was the first person to amass a personal fortune of $1 billion. And this guy had everything you could ever imagine. And once the question was put to him, how much money does it take to be satisfied? And his brief answer said so much. $1 more. It takes $1 more. In other words, however much you've got, it is never, never, ever quite enough. And then there's our thirst for possessions. Now, I don't know what your thing is in this area, but for me, it's gadgets. As many of you know, I'm a big sucker for anything that Apple put out there, pretty much. So of course, I followed with great interest the launch of the iPhone 5 a couple of weeks ago. For any of you who, for some tragic reason, managed to miss the launch of the iPhone 5, I'm now going to fill you in on a couple of the key headline details. There are numbers on there that you can't see at all, but that's a comparison between iPhone 4S, the previous version, and then iPhone 5. Now, iPhone 5 is just 7.6 millimeters thin, and it weighs an incredible 112 grams. It is the thinnest and lightest iPhone in the world ever. Until iPhone 6, of course, but anyway. Now, the day before the iPhone 5 was released, I was very happy with and satisfied with my iPhone 4S. But the day after iPhone 5 came out, something big happened. You see, the iPhone 4S is a whopping great 9.3 millimeters thick. And it weighs a gargantuan 140 grams. So suddenly I've got to get out of bed and face the day with a phone that is 1.7 millimeters thicker than the iPhone 5. You know, frankly, it's a wonder I've been able to keep going. And previously I could walk around with my iPhone 4S in my pocket without great difficulty. I bore its 140 grams with carefree ease, quite frankly. But now every step I take is a reminder of the unbearable additional 28 grams that I am lugging around everywhere I go. I mean, it's astonishing that I haven't ended up with back problems already, to be quite honest with you. Now, I guess you know I'm joking, mostly. But, you know, there's something in that that I guess most of you can relate to. You might not care one little bit about iPhones. I'm very glad if you don't. But for you, it might be that next pair of jeans, that next pair of shoes. It might be the next home improvement, the next room that you decorate, the next kitchen that you get redone, the next bathroom, the next extension plan. It might be the next holiday, the next bike, the next car. That thing, whatever it is that you need to be happy, that thing that you just itch for until you get it, the thing that you think will satisfy you, and yet when you get it, it never does. It never does. Some of you who come to Cambridge more often will have heard me quote this once before, but I think it's so perceptive, I want to share it with you again. A guy called Todd Gitlin wrote a book called Media Unlimited. Todd Gitlin is a sociologist, and he published this book in 2001, so it refers to things from the dim and distant past, like CD players. And if you don't know what that is, ask your parents. But he writes this brilliant comment about our insatiable thirst for material things. He says, "Of course, the curious thing about consumer pleasures is that they don't last. The essence of consumerism is broken promises ever renewed. You propel your daydreams forward, each time attaching them to some longed-for object, a sofa, a CD player, a kitchen, a sports car, only to unhook the desires from the objects once they are in hand. Even high-end, durable goods quickly outwear the thrill of their early arrival, leaving consumers bored and available. After each conquest comes a sense only of limited satisfaction and the question, what next?" You see what he's saying, don't you? That we're on an endless and hopeless quest. So we want something, and we believe the promise that it offers us, that if we get it, it will fulfill and satisfy and complete us. But when we get it, we find that promise that it made was a lie. iPhone 4S doesn't bring you contentment, after all. It's a broken promise, and so we're still left empty. We're still left hungering for more. And he says, those broken promises, we just ever renew them. So we say, well, I thought iPhone 4S would do it. Obviously, I was wrong, but iPhone 5 will do it. And so we hunt for the next one. Even with its dodgy maps, it'll make me happy. But we do it with all these things. You know, you get the new kitchen and finally it's installed, and yet life is pretty much the way it always was. So you say, well, it's the new bathroom that's going to do it too. And so the broken promise gets ever renewed, this time with the iPad, with the bathroom, with the extension, with the holiday, with the Mercedes, whatever it is. And the endless cycle of disappointment continues. Broken promises ever renewed. For others, career success is what they're looking for, to find the fulfillment that they want. You know, many people in our society are basing their identity on the work that they do. And they're doing so believing that the next promotion, the next successfully completed project, the next professional achievement will give them that sense of meaning. But what about when you get to the very top of the ladder? As part of the BBC Olympics coverage this summer, the journalist Matthew Syed made a really, really interesting video. It's on the BBC website. Check it out if you get time. And in the video, he interviews a number of past gold medal-winning athletes. In his own words, "To win Olympic gold is the dream of millions and the privilege of just a tiny few. But what is winning gold actually like?" Here are some of the things the athletes said. Matthew Pinson, the rower, he said, "You imagine life will completely change. You imagine life will be perfect. And actually, it isn't." Denise Lewis said this, "I remember being chauffeured back in the bus to the athletes' village after doing my press conference. And I sat there thinking to myself, what are you going to do now? You've done it. And that feeling alone made me feel kind of depressed You know, this girl has just reached the very pinnacle of her career, and she sat on a bus with a gold medal around her neck, and she's depressed. Chris Boardman, the cyclist, said of those striving for gold, their entire life is wrapped up in getting this one thing. And they believe this one thing is going to be the answer. Once I've got this, I'll be satisfied. But they get there and find out that it isn't. And the last word was saved for Jonathan Edwards, the triple jumper, who said, if this wasn't the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, what is? That's a great question. It really is a good question. Now, most of us haven't reached that kind of success. And so we can kid ourselves that if we do, in whatever field it might be, it'll truly bring us contentment. But that's why we need to listen to those who have reached the top. Tom York, the lead singer of the band Radiohead, he gave an interview to the magazine NME. They asked him about his ambitions, and he gave a really, really honest reply. He said, ambitious for what? What for? I thought when I got to where I wanted to be, everything would be different. I'd be somewhere else. I thought it would all be white, fluffy clouds, and then I got here, and I'm still here. The interviewer asked him why he continues to make music, even though he's reached the critical acclaim that he ever hoped for, and commercial success beyond what many of us would ever reach. Why does he continue to make music? To which he replied, it's filling the hole. That's all anyone does. And then he was asked this, what happens to the hole? And Tom York paused for a long time before answering, it's still there. It's still there. I wonder if you identify with that experience. Maybe there have been targets that you set, achievements that you aspired to, accomplishments that you longed for, positions you dreamed of. And then you got them. And you achieved them. And you thought, when you got there, everything would be different. You thought you would be different. But then you got there, and you're still here. And the hole is still there. Let's touch on just one more. And that's popularity. You know, I think deep down this is the big one that is driving so many people's lives. It's the craving for the affirmation of other people, because only when we get affirmation from other people do we feel like we're worth anything. Only in the affirmation of other people do we feel like that need is met. So we need to be popular. We need to be admired. We need to be liked. But again, it never lasts. I think the place I've maybe seen this put best is an interview with Madonna in Vogue magazine. And she said this, my drive in life comes from a fear of being mediocre. That is always pushing me. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, but then I feel I am still mediocre and uninteresting unless I do something else. And then listen to this. Because even though I have become somebody, I still have to prove that I am somebody. My struggle has never ended, and I guess it never will. You see what she's saying? She can never rest. She's never done enough. She never feels like it's enough to feel satisfied. Every time she thinks she has it, every time she thinks she's got this, she needs to find it all over again. It's insatiable. The tank is empty. The cupboard is bare again. I've become somebody, but I still need to become somebody. And so do we all. Yeah, we're all trying to find that sense of self, and we're doing it in different ways. Some are looking to power, others to relationships, others to being a good moral person. But whatever it is, we're building our identity on something. But Jesus is challenging us with something massive here. What good is it to gain the whole world but lose your soul? Now, that word soul that you read in verse 36 in the Bibles that we've got here, it's a translation from the Greek language in which the New Testament was originally written. And the word that's translated soul in verse 36 is the exact same word that comes again and again in this passage wherever you read the word life. The word Jesus is using is really the word life. But whereas in English we've got just the one word life, in the Greek language there are three words for life. And they each mean different things. And Jesus uses all three at different times very deliberately. Which means that the choice of word Jesus goes for here is important. And it's the word psyche, from which we get psychology and its related words. It's the Greek word that describes your inner self, your identity. So do you see what Jesus is saying in that question? He's saying if you build your life on any of the things this world has got to offer you, you'll never find it. You'll lose your life. And why? It's because you and I and every other human being was built for something bigger. We were made for something more. Centuries ago, a theologian called Augustine wrote a book about his own journey to faith. And in it, he penned these words. O Lord, you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. If you want it in a more contemporary way, a writer, Simone Veil, said this, all sins are attempts to fill voids. Because we cannot stand the God-shaped hole inside of us, we try stuffing it full of all sorts of things, but only God can fill it. You know, Augustine, Simone Veil, they're only really just saying what Jesus already said before them. In the second option he puts before us, which I've called this, gain Jesus and save your life. What I've been doing so far is really to suggest to you that we will never really find life and satisfaction and contentment in anything this world has got to offer. That's kind of what I've been trying to do. But what I want to do next is just begin, really only begin, to suggest to you that the only way you can find it is in building your life and your identity on Jesus. Have a look at how he puts it in verse 35. He says, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. So Jesus says, the way that you get life is to lose it for him and the gospel. Now, as an idea, that just sounds bizarre and it sounds ludicrous to our ears, doesn't it? The idea that to get life, you lose your life. And we think, you know, what on earth is this man talking about? The idea that I will find life through giving up my self-centered pursuit of the things in this world and instead centering my life on this person, Jesus, it sounds an absurd idea. It sounds oppressive. It sounds suspicious. You know, give up your life to me and make me your reason for living and you'll truly find life. And it sounds restrictive. It sounds like you're going to give away the keys to the freedom of your life. But, you know, Jesus is saying in this section, don't you see? None of the things this world has got to offer you will ever do it. They're never going to be enough. It's what Madonna and Tom York and all those Olympic medalists and countless other people are finding. Every next income bracket I reach, every next gadget I buy, every next item of clothing I put on, every next accomplishment I achieve, every next relationship I find, oh, they never fill the hole. The hole is still there. But Jesus here is claiming to be the one who can finally fill the hole. He's saying, look, come to me, and if you will lay down your endless and hopeless pursuit of gaining the whole world, and come to me, I will fill that hole. I will end your searching. I will still your striving. In me you will find life. In me you will save your life. Now that is a monumentally big offer. How do you know he can be trusted? The way that you know he can be trusted is only by seeing what Jesus has first done for you. It's only by seeing what Jesus had to do to make it possible for you to know the life that you long for. See, back in verse 31, Jesus says some things about himself that spark off this whole section we've been looking at. Look at what he says of himself in verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man, that's a title Jesus used of himself, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Jesus is foretelling his own death on the cross. There used to be an exhibition in the Millennium Dome. Can you remember the Millennium Dome? It's what the O2 Arena used to be. And in that exhibition, there was a display of great figures of history, influential people through the centuries. And as you would expect, there was a section about Jesus Christ. And as it summed up Jesus Christ, it said this: he was a great teacher who died tragically young. Well, not if you actually read what Jesus said about himself, because here he's saying, I must suffer and be rejected and killed. I have to be killed. In other words, Jesus' death wasn't going to be a tragic accident, but rather something that he was going to willingly and knowingly. But why? Why would you do that? Why would you willingly and knowingly go to a horrific death? Well, it is because for you and I to know the life we long for you to have that hole finally filled, for you to be restored to knowing the God who made you, Jesus had to die. Now, there's not time this morning to unpack why that is the case, and I'm going to say more at the end about how you can find out more. But here's the big thing I want you to see. In asking and inviting you to build your life on him, Jesus is saying to you, I want you to make me the center of your life. He's saying to you, I want you to give yourself up for me. But he is only asking you to do what he has already done for you. You know, Jesus has given himself to the utmost for you. On the cross, Jesus gave up his life so that you could discover yours. On the cross, Jesus Christ lost his life so that you could find yours. On the cross, Jesus emptied himself of everything he was so that you could finally be filled. You know, even if you don't believe that to be true, surely you should want that to be true. Because there is nothing in this world that you could live for that would ever do that for you. Now, as we wrap up, maybe today is just the very beginning of you beginning to think about these things. We're all living for something. We all need that cosmic significance, as Becca put it. We all need to fill the hole. And maybe some of what we've looked at resonates with you. Perhaps you recognize in yourself that need or that appetite for life, that appetite for true identity, for a true sense of yourself. Maybe you see in your own life something of that endless cycle of disappointment. Maybe you think, yeah, my life is broken promises ever renewed. Perhaps your life has been one of constantly thinking, if I get to that next peak, I'll be there. That'll be the summit, but then you get there only to find that the path stretches endlessly out in front of you, and contentment ever eludes your grasp. Jesus asks you, he looks you in the eye and asks you, what good is it to gain the whole world and lose your life? Is that what you're doing? Are you always searching but never finding? Because if you are, Jesus invites you to come to him and to give your life over to him. Now sure, that is really scary. That is really scary. It might be the last thing you ever imagined yourself doing. But he has first done that for you on the cross. He's given everything for you. He laid down his life so that yours could truly begin. And he's claiming nothing less than this: if only you will start to build your life on him, only then will you begin to really find life at all. I want to end by reading a short passage to you from a book called Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. He writes this: give up yourself and you'll find your real self. Lose your life and you will save it. Submit to the death of your own ambitions and favorite wishes every day. Submit with every fiber of your being and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will ever be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin and decay. But look for Christ and you will find him, and with him everything else thrown in.